is forever passing. So Uranus is eternal time, within which things neither grow old, nor have beginning, nor have end. And Uranus is the free symbol of the golden age, and all the divine worlds, and all the divine powers that inhabit them. Now, eternity, or unaging time, gives birth to time, as we know it, by a mystery. And the firstborn of heaven was Cronus, or Saturn. And Saturn is time. And it is time that turns and unthrones its own father, taking upon itself the control of the universe, and forces its own will upon creation. So Saturn, or time, or Cronus, rebels against eternity and usurps the kingdom. And from that time, all things are the slaves of time. Now to the Greeks, time was not just a dimension, something that you measure on a clock. Time was a living thing. And it is not impossible that we shall ultimately come to this same realization, that time is a creature with a body, a form, and a kind, and that time will never be solved, or its mystery will never be understood, until we realize that time is a conscious entity and not merely a flowing of years as we think of it. Perhaps some of the researches of Einstein have suggested that time is more than first meets the eye, a great and universal mystery not easily solved. Now, time, having taken over the universe, is very jealous, and therefore time, having emasculated its own father and destroyed it, or obscured it by its own laws, because in this case destruction means the submergence of a previous state. And this is actually the destruction of objectivity. For the moment man becomes objectively aware, he destroys a subjective pre-state, or forces what he was once conscious of back into his unconscious, whereas he polarizes a new level of consciousness. So eternity is destroyed by being submerged behind the illusion of time. This the Greeks were well aware of. And Saturn has a considerable progeny. But because Saturn is time, and because time has within itself the power to absorb everything which is created within it, Saturn devours all of his own children. Because time absorbs or dissolves or destroys or returns to itself everything which is engendered from it. For nothing that is born in time can have an eternal duration. So that which is part of time dies in time. Worlds, having fallen under the yoke of time, must be dissolved. All compounds existing within time must again be resolved into their basic elements. But by a subterfuge, Zeus was preserved, and Saturn received instead of his son a stone to devour. And Zeus, therefore, escaped from the power of time. And by Zeus, the Greeks understood, therefore, the next logoi power. And this was the power of law. The lawful universe, which in its turn overcame time. Now again, it simply means not that time was destroyed, but Zeus turned and took again the kingdom from his father. And he did so by placing his own power objectively before his father. And out of the mystery of this circumstance comes the symbolism of the great power of universal law. Now, law and order, or the great integration, the establishment of a vast sense of legality in space, the setting up of the great laws, obscures the mystery of time. And today, in the personal power of Zeus, we have the beginning or the dawn of the human objective consciousness. For in Zeus we have self, the concept of self, which stands firmly against the mystery of time. The human being has never acknowledged as a psychic fact within himself the experience of time. And he opposes the limitation of time by the eternity within himself. And he seeks also to defeat time by the organization of the universe. And we have a common word we use today in connection with mechanistic organization: time saving. To make time stretch. To get more into time, to defeat time, to break the power of time to break us. And the way we defeat time is by the establishment of the power of Zeus, or the logos of self-consciousness. And self-consciousness stands against time. Now, in turn, Zeus, having been established as the supreme power of those deities which may not know its own essential nature, the chief of the intellectual powers of nature, corresponding with the third logos of the Christian Greek theology, corresponding again in the scriptures with the prince of this world, or the Gnostic Ildabaoth, or the Greek Demiurgus, or the Egyptian deity Osiris. These are all gods of the world, gods of objective creation. For up to this time, creation has been a subjective power. The gods, therefore, like the Hindu divinities and the northern Buddhist divinities, are represented as 12. These 12 actually being the manifestations or emanations of Zeus, who becomes a kind of zodiac, within whose nature the mundane world takes place or comes into existence. And this concept is preserved, of course, in the 12 patriarchs, the 12 apostles, the 12 disciples, and all of the mysteries of the 12, and the association of the sun and the zodiac. Now, the rise of the 12 objective powers of consciousness, which constitute the total nature of Zeus, forces into objectivity by the law of emanationism, as understood in the Gnostic and Kabbalistic teaching. The moment a positive power is manifested, a negative receptivity comes into existence. Every light creates a shadow. Every positive power brings forth out of the abyss its shadow, its negative reflection. So when the 12 gods seated themselves upon the Olympic throne as the 12 powers of the conscious self, either in the solar system or in man, the result immediately was the arising from space, from chaos, from the under part, from the world below, from the formless materials from which the world was to be fashioned, there arose 12 giants, or 12 chaotic powers called the Titans. And for vast ages of time, the gods and the Titans were locked in conflict. And this conflict consisted of the struggle between cosmos as law and chaos as matter. And what we are actually confronted with is this problem of law imposing itself upon matter, and the great conflict between activity and inertia, the great conflict of organizing the vast area of material resource into the likeness and similitude of the divine plan. Now this struggle went on for a great period of time. And the struggle apparently was purposeless, ageless, and meaningless, until law, which was, of course, the direct descendant of heaven by divine right, although each had achieved its end by usurpation. In other words, each one had stolen the kingdom. And in this, you concentrate upon the concept of the diminishing or lowering levels of consciousness, in which each lower degree achieves its end by stealing the kingdom from a higher degree. So that by the time we get down to what the metaphysician of the 19th century called mortal mind, we're down very close to Zeus. And somewhere in the background, divine mind has been deprived unjustly of its kingdom. So these degrees of consciousness all represent the stealing of something greater, or the locking of something greater, or the submerging of something greater, and a lesser power taking over. Until in the person or in the concept of Zeus, we have personal consciousness, the egoic self, self-will. We have the concept of a man as master of the universe, or of the deity who is to mold the world according to its own nature, taking the place gradually of the great God who has been obscured. This can only happen, of course, if this lesser deity belongs to an intellectual order of gods, because the prerequisite of rebellion is that this power does not know its own source. If it knew its own source, it could not rebel. Therefore, Zeus can know anything of what it is going to what is going to come from him, what is to do. But where he came from, he cannot know. Therefore, he becomes a free agent, like man. And because he is a free agent, he creates a world in the abyss and locks that world in a terrible struggle, which we find also emphasized in the Götterdämmerung, or the ultimate conflict of light and darkness, the Armageddon, or the last great war of Egypt, or the battlefield of Kurukshetra in the Hindic classic, the Bhagavad Gita. Now, Zeus is law, beholds itself locked forever with the Titans. Law fighting, and darkness reacting. And the more violently law imposes itself, the more violently the Titans react. Until these two powers become involved in the tremendous struggle, which almost might be regarded as equivalent to the strivings of a nebular hypothesis in space, the world coming into existence. Then it is that Zeus unites with Semele, a mysterious symbol of sleep or of dreams. Perhaps we have almost a yogic. Zeus, by interior visualization or fantasy, creates within himself or impregnates illusion or imagination simile with his own son, who is the likeness of himself. Simile is destroyed by the blaze of the celestial power of Zeus himself. The child is rescued and placed in an artificial womb in the thigh of Zeus, and there it is maintained until birth, and there is born from the thigh of Zeus, from the union of law and fantasy or imagination, is born horned Zagreus, Dionysus, later Bacchus. Therefore, Bacchus becomes the only begotten of law, and in turn, the god of ecstasy. Dionysus, which is the true deity, the lord of the vine, the dance, and the theater. Dionysus is the deity that has no evil and no negative or destructive power within it whatever. Now there are many, many fables concerning this deity. But in the oldest forms, this deity is nearly always represented as a small child with some of the attributes of Cupid, who is also very important, far more than merely a sentimental divinity as we are inclined to think. But Bacchus is the one, or Dionysus, is the one for whom Zeus intends the kingdom. For Zeus feels that in this Dionysus, or the god of the sacred dance, is the ultimate rulership of the empire to be vested. Therefore, Zeus ordered Bacchus to be brought up in a mountain, and appointed to him in the beginning a panther for a nurse. Now, it's interesting, of course, that in the old Jewish rites and stories, it is said that the original name of Jesus was Jehoshua ben Pantera, which means Jehoshua, or Jesus, the son of the panther. This legend carries through in an important manner. The first miracle of Dionysus, or Bacchus, was the transforming of water into wine at a wedding feast. IHS, now seen on the altar cloths of churches, is the original monogram of Dionysus. He was the vine, and ye are the husbandman. He was the lord of the vine. And he was also the first deity of the Greco-Western world to be ritually worshipped by the Eucharist. Now, the condition of Dionysus in this particular problem is most intriguing. He is the heir to the kingdom. Yet he is not a deity of law primarily, but a deity of visions. A deity who went around the world associated with dance and flowers and surrounded by spirits who sang and danced with him. And he was given old Silenus for a teacher, a strange and ancient man who was most mysteriously wise. And old Silenus more or less represented in those days what our term silence means today. For inspiration was given silence as its master, a very proper and appropriate state of affairs, indicating that we are definitely dealing with meaningful circumstances. Now, while this deity, Dionysus, was still a very small lad, Zeus gave him the universe as a plaything. And he gave to him a mysterious whirling toy, like a top that spins. and which some mythologists have considered to be a symbol of the chakra of Vishnu, the wheel, the symbol of cosmic motion. And this music, some of which later returned in the symbolism of the deity Pan. But one thing that this deity, this wonderful, radiant, glorious child, was forever warned, was that he must not wander far from Olympus. Because if he wandered too far away, he might come to the end of law and order, as ruled over by Zeus, seated upon his ancient throne and watching the world with his single eye. And if the little godling should wander too far away, he might fall into the clutches of the Titans or the chaotic forces of nature and be destroyed. But the Titans, or the negative powers, were determined to destroy Dionysus because they conceived in him the power of ecstasy by means of which that could be accomplished which law could not achieve. They knew also that this god of beauty was to sometime take the place of law, and that beauty was sometime rule the world. And that beauty, which was the first begotten of law, contained all law within itself, but something else, vision. This mysterious power of ecstasy. So they made a mirror, did these wicked, nasty Titans. And they caused this deity to see itself reflected in the mirror, and Narcissus-like, it followed its own reflection, thinking it had found a playfellow in space. And when they had lured the god far away from the throne of Zeus, the Titans turned upon the infant Dionysus and slew him. And of course his spirit or soul returned to Zeus to be born again later. But his body was torn apart and was cooked upon a fire by the Titans, and they devoured the infant's body. Now Zeus, upon his mighty throne, was not able to foresee or to see the Titans, but he smelt the burning flesh. And he then caused his attention to become set upon this mystery and saw what had occurred. And he sent Pallas Athena, born from his own mind, like Brunhilde, born from the will of Odin. And he caused her to take the head and soul of Dionysus and return it to him. This is like the head of Orpheus, that continued to give oracles after the body had been torn apart by the Cyconian women. And after the head and soul had been rescued, Zeus turned his thunderbolts upon the Titans and completely incinerated them in his wrath. And he changed them into ashes. And then from these ashes, which contained the blood of Dionysus, the gods fashioned the bodies of the first human beings. And that therefore all human beings are composed of the ashes of the Titans and the blood of Dionysus. Now it would be quite incredible to assume that such stories had merely a fabulous intent, that they deal with very deep and obscure and arcane mysteries of life we cannot easily doubt. For we realize that from that time on, Zeus could not destroy man, because if he turned again his wrath against the Titans, he turned also his hate against the blood of his own son. So from that point on, Zeus could not destroy man without turning his wrath against his own blood. And of course the blood of Dionysus represented the soul power in man, or the divine presence of the Logos. And Dionysus was again reborn, and his mysteries and rites were established. and he performed the great mysteries by which man was to be educated and restored. But over the power of law, therefore, came the power of love and beauty in the power of Dionysus. And therefore, Socrates declares the great powers of the universe to be the one, the beautiful, and the good. And the beautiful is in each case the power of the redemption by ecstasy, or by the internal vision of reality. Now, the mystery of this, again, occurs in an entirely different similitude in another fable. And that is when Aeneas descends into the underworld, and also when Kore descends into the abode of Hades, or Dis, to rescue her son, her daughter Persephone, who had been abducted. In order to descend into the underworld and return alive, it is necessary that the traveler should find the golden bough that grows upon the tree. There is only one golden bough in the world of time. And it is a strange thing that, like a mistletoe or an orchid, has no root of its own, but grows upon some other tree hidden in the forest. Who carries this bough will be able to pass the three-headed dog upon the threshold, and may safely go into the lower world and return again. What is this mysterious golden bough? We have no question from the context of the story that this bough represents the intuitional soul of man, which grows not upon its own tree, but upon another tree, and who possesses it can descend into the underworld or the world of matter and return alive, because of the power of the psychic nature within. This is again a symbol very close to the essential meaning of Dionysus, who becomes in its various embodiments and powers the symbol of universal beauty and the psychic life of man himself. Thus, in these legends and mysteries, we have some very interesting and valuable accounts, telling us of great and important matters, telling us much of philosophy and of the deeper mysteries of religion and of the great sacred ritual dramas of antiquity. Now, we also must face and recognize always the arising of the great hero cycle. And we must also realize that the Greeks represented a kind of human being who, after death, could be taken to heaven and become a constellation. And many of the constellations of the zodiac and the non-zodiacal bands were originally supposed to have been heroes, like Cassiopeia or the winged horse, Pegasus, and all these different symbols for when some very great and glorious achievement occurred, then the soul might be taken up and become a star or a constellation. And in the story of the soul, we have perhaps an excellent example of the great classic drama of Greece, Oedipus Rex, which gives us another important commentary on this matter. Oedipus is one of the deities that, like Moses and Sargon and many others, including Romulus, was discarded by its parents, or his parents, and set out to die. Was discovered by a shepherd and taken to the court of a neighboring king. Now, all this happened because of an oracle. For before the birth of this child, Oedipus, the oracle said that he would kill his own father, marry his own mother, and destroy the empire. So when the child was born, its parents were naturally loath to rear it and left it to die. But before this, they pierced its feet so that it would always have great trouble in walking. Raised in the family of a neighboring king, like Moses, and not aware that these were its foster parents and not its own, young Oedipus became aware of the story of the oracle, and fearing that his foster parents were his own and would therefore feel the curse, he left them that he might never cause them ill. And upon the road, coming upon a charioteer and a rich prince, there was an argument in which he slew both the charioteer and the man in the chariot, who proved to be his own father. He then later confronted the Sphinx, a mysterious monster with many parts compounded. And this monster ravaged the road of Thebes, and all who could not answer her riddle perished. And the Thebans offered the widow of their king in marriage to the man who could destroy the Sphinx. Oedipus was able to do so by answering the riddle, for the riddle and the answer were both man. Thus he returned to Thebes, married his mother as the oracle had foretold, and was later convicted of the murder of his father. He had placed a curse upon the murderer of his father without knowing that he was the murderer. And in the catastrophes and tragedies that followed, his life was one terrible, embittered existence, until finally he was brought to peace by the graces, and in a little grove gave up his spirit and returned to the other world. It was a very tragic and terrible story. But let us remember that here we have two tremendous conflicts. First of all, we have the riddle of the Sphinx. And the Sphinx, as we know, was always among ancient peoples the symbol of the unknown. The Sphinx was consequently the symbol, in a way, of nature, whose various parts are always represented as a compound. Oedipus is now the world hero. But Oedipus is more than this. Oedipus becomes the symbol of wisdom, the power which can destroy or solve the riddle of the unknown. Now, many men had attempted to answer the mystery and had all died. But Oedipus succeeded for one reason only, namely that he was crippled in his feet. And being crippled in his feet, he could not hurry. Therefore, wisdom bestows judgment, which prevents haste. And because he was without haste, because knowledge was not a victim of imprudent action, Oedipus was said to be able to solve the mystery. Like Hippocrates, the god of silence and wisdom of the Egyptians, who was also crippled in his lower parts. Because judgment cannot move fast, nor can wisdom be quickly perfected. All knowledge is imperfect in its lower parts, because it is without a full knowledge of its own foundation. The Sphinx, representing chimera or illusion, is man's struggle to solve the mystery of all things, to learn in the end that the mystery of everything is the mystery of himself, that who solves himself solves all. Then, as Lord Bacon points out in the Mysteries of the Ancients, the Wisdom of the Ancients, knowledge having overcome ignorance or illusion, or science having defeated the unknown, the carcass of the unknown is placed upon the body of an ass. For once knowledge is possessed by the wise, it can then be passed on to the foolish, and they can carry it forever. But wisdom comes upon its own tragedy, because the very wisdom that solves riddles is the wisdom of a broken heart, and wisdom is the carrier of the world's great tragedy. For that which by wisdom has destroyed illusion finds no happiness or security itself. It ends as a wanderer, blind and miserable, until finally it is brought to peace by the gracious deities of some far distant grove. There is no peace in the world for wisdom itself, because wisdom partakes of the nature of Zeus, but not of the nature of Dionysus. And it is the power of Dionysus that must save or redeem all of these things. Now, in the Greek legendary also, we have the story of worlds and how they come into being. Zeus is called the aerial deity because he abides in the sky, so called. And he is the etheric envelope, or auric field, which encloses the solar system. Now, Zeus manifests in turn through two other aspects of himself, for he is a triad of deities. In his own nature, he is called Zeus, and abides in the etheric diffusion. In his humid or liquid nature, he is called Poseidon or Neptune. And Neptune was called the aquatic Zeus, for it is the same deity in another element. And when enclosed in the mystery of generation or matter, or as the substance of the world power locked within the atom, or within the material substances of nature, as the power which grows up through the earth with the budding grain, in these natures, Zeus is called Dis, spelled D-I-S, or the subterranean Zeus, or Hades. And all of these are one deity in three states. Therefore, in the higher or mental condition, Zeus is in his proper nature. In his vital or effluvid quality, known as his seminal nature, he is Neptune. And in his imprisoned or bodily aspect, he is Hades. These three natures, therefore, constitute together the one body of this god. And in this bodily structure, he refers also to the nature of man, because man consists of an intellectual nature, a vital or animative nature, and a material nature. Therefore, the objective consciousness of man imprisoned within body during the physical period of life is Dis, or Jupiter Hades. In the Latins, among the Latins, this Dis, or Hades, was called Pluto, or the compound god of death and wealth. Pluto, in his original nature, being the root of the word plutocracy, or plutocrat, indicated a well-financed state. Now, the Greeks and Latins were not wrong in this. Because, of course, it is only in the material world that plutocracy has any meaning. Thus, Hades is the god of accumulation. And we can almost have the same concept in the Buddhist philosophy, where it is what we have and what we want that keep us in a state of perdition. So Hades rules those who are in turn ruled by possession or by material things, of which he is the peculiar proprietor. His world is a world of dreams and of darkness. His world is a place where all things have a seemingly endless subsistence in monotony. The Greeks at that time, and later the Latins, felt that this traditional state was not one of punishment primarily, but one of continuance on a meaningless basis. You just went on doing unimportant things forever until you were bored with yourself and everyone else. You could have almost anything you wanted until you were so tired of it, you never wanted it again. Until finally the desire to achieve or to be dominated completely the sufficiency and complacency of things. Then when you cried out that you were surfeited with the possessional concept, you were reminded that you were in perdition. So Hades, or Dis, or Pluto, was appropriately and properly the god of the material world. Now what does this dead god of the material world signify in the compound nature of man? Obviously it is his objective personality. It is the part of himself which believes in the reality of matter, which believes in the supreme significance of the present state of things. So the individual in this state is said to have entered into the underworld, and here to remain, like Proserpine, half of each year, or half of each life cycle, or half of each day. Because in sleep, when man is nothing, perhaps he is free from the mystery of illusion. He apparently knows nothing. Perhaps then he knows all. And anyway, the Greeks had these dreams about such matters. Now, in order to descend into this world of darkness, it was necessary for man to be rowed across the river of Styx by a blind boatman in a strange, dark ship. And we are reminded of the words of Heraclitus, who said that only a dry soul is wise. Now, that doesn't sound as though this merely meant one that was in lack of liquid nourishment. But between the airy abode of Zeus, which was the Olympian Mount, and the pits of Tartarus, which were beneath it, there was also upon the side of the mountain the springs of Helicon, from which Pegasus, striking with his hoofs, brought forth the waters of eternal life. The abode of the Muses and the Graces, and the great band of those that followed the Pythian Apollo. And here we come also to the river, which was called the River of Life, or the River of Waters, that flowed mysteriously between the upper world and the lower. And this watery abode, this humid mystery, was under the control of Neptune. And Neptune was therefore lord of the seas, and of all things that had to do with waters, and to him were given the control of all the continents and lands that existed at the sea, and he was, of course, the great deity who presided over the mystery of Poseidonis, or the lost Atlantic Empire. But what were these waters primarily? According to Heraclitus, with his dry soul and several other problems, they represented the mystery of humidity. Humidity, in turn, being the secret of generation. Souls falling into generation, or falling into the world, first pass through the sphere of humidity, which was represented by the river, which divided the invisible world from the material one. And this river, like water, which is Maya, or illusion, Mari, or the sea, Isis, Isa, the waters, all of these represent the symbol of illusion. And those who would enter into materiality must first drink of the water of Lethe and must forget reality. So once the soul enters into the mystery of generation, it loses the memory of its divine origin and falls into the mystery of birth. And having thus entered into the mystery of birth, it is unable to escape therefrom. On the other hand, the soul escaping through redemption, or the heroic state, must rise through the symbol of water and be carried to the other shore in the ship of the doctrine, as the Northern Buddhist says. And we also have in the good old Christian hymn one more river to cross, and that is the river of illusion. And we will be united with all our friends on the other shore, which is again the river of illusion. And that is why we have in the ancient Christian symbol of the church, the original church built in the form of a ship, for the reason, as in the fisherman's ring of the papacy, for the reason that the ship of the doctrine must carry the soul across the sea of illusion. This is the great expedition of the Argonauts, seeking for the golden fleece. This is, again, part of the wanderings of Odysseus, or Ulysses, who, being a hero of the order of Poseidonis, or the sea, was forced to overcome the oceans, or overcome illusion, in order to return to his native land. All these legends go on and on and on, and every one of them can be broken down into some part of the mysterious and psychic life of man himself. We also can see the thinking of this in the statement of Plato, that in the beginning of the world, the Logos impressed itself upon space in the form of a cross. We have an early recognition of the symbol of the cross and the Logos. We have the gradual rise of the rituals and mysteries which have caused men like Voltaire to insist that Plato should have been the first canonized saint of the Christian Church, because the greater part of the deeper rituals of Christianity were derived from the great symbolism of the Orphic mysteries and the great rituals of the Greek philosophies. Contemplating in such a manner upon fables, we can see why minds like Socrates and Plato would have regarded them as indispensable, and also why each in his turn might have invented others, or given new color and meaning to those already invented, and thus advanced this great philosophical, symbolical language, which, when properly used and understood, transforms every one of these stories into a valid statement of universal laws. And the delight of this is that these valid statements are not the same as you will find literally presented in books. They are not the kind of statements that you can get even today from an approved text, although we've had 2,300 years since Plato to clarify these points. These statements have a strange, mysterious, mystical vitality in them, which is totally lost in what we call the exact knowledge of today. And in one simple fable is concealed more of reality than in some great text most scholarly produced and most detailedly analyzed. And furthermore, these fables sink immediately and inevitably into the consciousness of man, rising in him again through some reminiscence, through some recollection of things partly known or suspected, until they coax out of man some phase or shadow of his own psychic awareness. Thus they form an excellent and appropriate method of instruction.